these deaf ears. Israel defiantly insists it will perform an operation on Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have taken shelter. This has faced global criticism and stern warnings, even from Israel's closest ally, the U.S. In the meantime, truce negotiations are still ongoing in Doha, Qatar, though with no breakthrough. So far, Israel's Holocaust in Gaza has killed more than 32,000 Palestinians. Some 500,000 Gazans are already facing starvation, and many more are on the brink. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, is joining me from London. Also with us is Shabir Rizvi, political commentator in Chicago.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me welcome both our guests. Welcome, both of you. So, beginning with Kim. Kim, you are a lawyer. At last, the U.S. abstained, deciding not to use its veto power to UN Security Council. What, in your mind's eye, motivated Washington to do so? And does this mean a change of heart in its policies vis-a-vis the Tel Aviv regime? Is it a publicity stunt or what?
Yeah, good afternoon to you. It seems to me that after I've analyzed the situation very carefully and I've been thinking about it and I've listened very carefully to the speech of the U.S. representative at the UN Security Council as to why they have abstained, it is very obvious to me, and I don't know about others, but it's very obvious to me that it was a publicity stunt. The U.S. is aware that the whole world is now totally against its position in relation to supporting this genocidal regime. And it has lost a moral compass, it has lost the moral authority, it has lost a great deal perhaps we can't even measure it at this stage. And therefore, it has decided to take this position make it seem like it is concerned and it wants the right thing to happen and so forth. But when you listen to the speech of the U.S. representative at the Security Council, you will see that her entire focus and attention was on basically blaming and deflecting, blaming the whole delay in getting the resolution voted on the Chinese and the Russians, and right, forgetting completely that they themselves three times vetoed a proposal to end the genocidal campaign of the Israeli regime. And so it seems to me that this was clearly a political stunt, because if they really want to stop the genocide, the Holocaust in Palestine today, all they have to do is make a phone call, and I'm pretty confident that they will be obeyed, because they will be able to cut military aid, they will be able to cut all kinds of other aid, they will be able to put to bear a huge pressure on them, they will be able to sanction them. Okay. So it is this stunt doesn't work, and I am not persuaded. I don't know about others.
Okay, now, Shabir, all UN Security Council resolutions are considered binding, and this is in accordance with Article 25 of the UN Charter, which is ratified by the United States. But this one, the U.S. has described the Monday resolution as non-binding. How's that?
Yeah, that's certainly interesting. I mean, I think if we need to actually analyze history, there are actually dozens of UNSC resolutions that Israel has violated. Time and time again, we see it with the West Bank. We see it with Gaza. We see it with Lebanon. This is an occupation that cannot be trusted. And so what the United States is doing is they're saying it's non-binding. Why are they saying it's non-binding? Because they know right now Israel has become a pariah state. And not only has it become a pariah state, in the eyes of the international community, I would say, a lot of us have known from the very start it's been a pariah state, but all eyes are on Israel. Its image has never been more tattered. Its image has never been this horrific in the eyes of the international community. So what the United States is doing right now is saving face of its most loyal junior partner and saying that these are non-binding, in that it knows that Israel is going to violate the ceasefire resolution, whatever its terms may be. In fact, they're already violating it. There were several bombings last night. There were several massacres last night. And so what we see is that Israel is very much intent on continuing this carnage. And so, for one, the United States is trying to save face. And two, we know that from the get-go, the Israeli occupation will not honor this resolution, no matter what its terms may be.
Right. Now, Kim, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has canceled a visit of a ranking delegation to Washington, seemingly in protest at Monday's UN Security Council resolution, you know. And Bibi's already facing division among cabinet members, also opposition from the Israeli people who've been out on the streets for a long time, holding rallies against him and his policies. So would he, in your opinion, eventually get off his high horse, or would he still persist to act stubbornly?
I think this act of canceling his visit to the U.S. is just another one of those media game that they play to make it seem like, you know, they are now in a tiff. But that's not true, because if they are in a tiff, the genocide, the Holocaust would stop tonight. And that's a fact. Everyone knows it. And we don't need to be mincing our words about that. And this man's life, livelihood, political career, everything, together with his wife also, who's been accused of certain things, depends on continuation of this Holocaust in Gaza, because up to now, 6 months later, all he has achieved is damage the reputation of Israel in the world, cut its own possible benefit that it may have derived from any other sources if they had taken different course in relation to dealing with October the 7th. And so he's now in a situation where he hasn't achieved any of his objectives from the time he entered Gaza, other than committing a Holocaust that people are now comparing it to the Nazi Germany of the Second World War. And so him pretending that he's not going is to give America some kind of gravitas in the world platform, to make America seem like, you know, it's now taking a very firm stance towards Israel. And the reality is far from that. If it wants to take a firm stance, is for them to say, stop it now or else we are going to apply sanctions on you. We're going to send our troops there to you to make sure that you don't invade, do what you're threatening to do in Rafah. And do that kind of thing. They have done that many times before in relation to many other people, but not in relation to Palestine, because they are a party to this Holocaust. The U.S. regime is a party to this Holocaust. So is the U.K., unfortunately. Yemen is the only one that is upholding the international rule of law.
Right. Now, Shabir, officials in Tel Aviv have taken no heed of the U.N. call for ceasefire, nor have they abided by the ICJ ruling. So what else can be done to force the regime to stop this genocide or Holocaust or whatever else you call in Gaza?
Yes. So as we know, Israel is a pariah state. It doesn't care for what international mechanisms are being used against it. And so what it's going to have to come down to is that countries will have to take a bold stance. They're going to have to economically cut ties with the Zionist state. They're going to have to cut political ties with the Zionist state. They will have to turn to their own workers and their own local businesses and say, you cannot do business with the Zionist regime. This is what it's going to have to come down to. That, and of course, uplifting the resistance and politically backing the resistance. Because as you know, under international law, resistance against an occupying enemy is completely justified. as soon as that justification is made well known and it's honored internationally, as we saw China made similar comments a few weeks ago, we are going to see slowly but surely, sort of just like how South Africa, apartheid South Africa, you know, was diminished, the same diminishment of the Israeli regime. Right now, it's basically being politically, as it always has, it's being politically backed and militarily backed by the United States. As soon as countries are able to independently say we will no longer do business with the Zionist regime, that is when that first domino will fall, and it will create a cascading effect that's going to take care of the Israeli regime, that's going to make it eventually fall, because it cannot stand on its own two legs without any political and economic assurances from basically the Western world.
Now, Kim, let's now review Israel's failure in the Gaza war. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is now in Tehran, and he says that Palestinians have shown, in his words, legendary resistance in the war, and that Israel has failed to achieve any of its military objectives. Let's face it, you know, it's a fact. IOF has failed to defeat even one single Palestinian resistance group.
Yes, you know, this is remarkable. It's been 75 years or so that this regime has been applying this genocidal schemes, because genocide is not a one-off action of one party against another. Genocide is a thing, is a process, a thing that takes time. So over the past 75 years, they have been applying this genocidal policy towards the Palestinian people, yet, remarkably, they remain steadfast, strong, and carry on their resistance operation, which is their inalienable right guaranteed by the UN Charter. And occupied people are entitled to do whatever is necessary to resist the occupation. And the occupation doesn't have rights. The occupation has obligations to preserve the lives of the occupied, to protect them, to do all kinds of things to make sure that their human dignity is not usurped from them. And so, yes, indeed, I totally agree that they haven't achieved any of their objectives, especially in relation to the current genocidal campaign. They haven't freed any of the hostages. They haven't eliminated Hamas, as they claim that they were doing. Instead, they were just applying collective punishment policies, killing everybody. And it is harrowing to hear what the UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, says today. She says, this is the genocide is in Gaza is so conspicuous and so ostentatious. And she's absolutely right. I'm quoting her verbatim there. She's absolutely right, because it's live, it's unfolding before the eyes of humanity all over the world. And yet these guys are arrogantly carrying on, and they assume that they're going to achieve something, and they are not going to. I totally agree with those who say that the people of Palestine have shown a remarkable, very moving fortitude and resilience and ability to resist their rather horrific, monstrous, nasty occupying force.
Right. Now, Shabir Rizvi, Ismail Haniyeh is saying that political support for the Tel Aviv regime is waning, and he cited the UN Security Council Monday resolution demanding a ceasefire. So we have pro-Palestine rallies in full swing around the world, as you know. We have Israel's allies, even their closest one, turning their backs. Boycotts of Israeli-made goods by a large number of countries underway. Severance of relations or limiting relations, summoning ambassadors, filing lawsuits in international fora. So what else could be in the offing?
Yeah, we're seeing multiple cascading effects of the October 7th resistance operation. Hamas has basically bloodied the nose of Israel to such an extent that they will never, ever be able to recover. I think what's going to happen now is a tightening of these different types of resistance that we're seeing, whether that's resistance directly on the ground from, you know, groups like Hamas or the PFLP, whether it's boycotts expanding. As you can see, more companies are being targeted to the point where, you know, sometimes even shipping lanes are being blocked. Airports are being stopped by, you know, groups here in the United States. And there's just more general political pressure being added onto specifically the United States political apparatus. As you can see from the primary results coming in, a lot of voters are saying that they're uncommitted to Joe Biden, specifically as a protest vote, due to his direct complicity in this genocide. And I think that's where it hurts the political system the most, because Joe Biden has been the number one backer of this genocide. If it were not for his policies, this would not have gone to the extent that it has. Now that the political pressure is being applied to the number one financier and the number one political backer of the Zionist regime, things are going to start changing. And it's not only just the voting that's going to be taken into effect. If you look at what's happening on the ground in the United States, politicians are being made uncomfortable. They're having these fundraiser events where activists are popping up and shutting down the fundraiser event. Roadways are being blocked. Highways are being blocked. Entire docks are being blocked. And I think the United States is at risk of losing its own political legitimacy if it keeps backing this genocide. Because as you can see, there's millions of people on the streets collectively, not only in the United States, but across the entire world. They all support Palestine. In fact, the only people that are supporting the Israeli cause are specific Zionist groups, people that are tricked into supporting Zionism, and of course the United States ruling class, who seeks to make, as Jared Kushner said, a port could, lead to a lot of revenue for the United States capitalist class. The people of the United States are directly at odds with their own ruling class. So why would they support some things? Why would they support Israel when they know that Israel is committing this genocide, is in bed with the ruling class that oppresses them day in and day out? There's no reason to support this. And the longer that the United States digs its heels into this genocide, the more contradictions arise between the population of the United States and the government of the United States, which clearly shows that it does not have the interests of the people at hand. It does not have the interest of peace and security at hand. Rather, it has the interests of a few select billionaire elite that want to expand their operations across West Asia and into Asia for their own personal gain.
Right. Turning to the humanitarian aid situation in Gaza, Kim, some people have been crushed to death, in a stampede. Some of them drowned while trying to get aid drop from the air. Some of them were hit by those, airdrop aid. So this kind of, aid airdrop, has proved not only humiliating, but deadly. I mean, if the donors really want to help the people in Gaza, why don't they simply force Israel to open land crossings?
Indeed. I mean, that is the easiest and the quickest way and the honest, bona fide method of alleviating the suffering there vis-a-vis the humanitarian catastrophe aspect of it. You have to also look at who is creating that environment, who is doing this. It's the Israeli vicious regime. It's doing it because it uses hunger as a weapon of war. It wants to flatten out the whole of Gaza. The whole conflict is now becoming clear that it is about to do with the natural mineral resources of Gaza itself. Apparently, there's so much gas in the Sea of Gaza. There is a talk about turning Gaza into an attractive holiday resort, and said it by Jared Kushner the other day. I saw an interview. Horrified to hear. This is the ultimate psychopathy. You don't have to be a psychologist expert to identify these people are very, very sick and dangerous people, because they don't seem to appreciate the value of human life. They don't seem to appreciate the importance of preserving a human life. Instead, they think people can just be exterminated systematically, like they're doing it now. Whether using hunger as a weapon of war, or denying them access to basic necessities like medicine and water, and just outright shooting them and bulldozing them, and continue to attack the same hospital over and over again, raping women. There are allegations of rape taking place by the Israeli soldiers there. And it's month of Ramadan, people are fasting. We understand what it is to be hungry and thirsty. Can you imagine what it is like for the people of Gaza? That has been the situation for nearly 20 years for them, and now it's just been intensified. What needs to happen is, just like Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur at the Human Rights Council, said today, she's calling for sanctions and embargo on Israel. The whole world needs to now stop dealing with them, literally kick their embassy ambassadors out, close down their embassies, and tell them, you're going to stop this systematic extermination of these people, or else we're not going to talk to you, we're not going to deal with you. And of course, we need to reprimand reprimand and maybe even have them investigated, those countries that have been creating a land passage for the Israeli vicious regime whilst the Gazans are starving. The air dropping off the food was pretty Hollywood movie stunt to make it seem like they care.
They're trying to do something.
This is a classic example where a narcissist or a psychopath pretends to have empathy. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
So these guys are psychopaths, they're dangerous, and the Palestinian people need to be protected from the evils of these people.
All right. Now, Shabir, Israel saying it cannot defeat Hamas without going into Rafah, where it says the movement has four battalions composed of 1,000 fighters. Now, even if that is true, would that be the right thing? I mean, to wipe out the entire population there to achieve the goal?
No, of course not. There's no reason for this siege to even be happening in the first place. And I'm not just even talking about after October 7th. I'm talking about the history of the besiegement of Gaza. What they're asking to do, what they're trying to gain approval for before they do it, is genocide, is ethnic cleansing. There are hundreds of thousands. There's a million people in there. It's the last place they have to go. And guaranteed, no matter what they do, as we have seen time and time again, year after year, they say that they have targeted bombings. That's just simply not true. Their bombs are unguided, and what they're trying to do is massacre as many people as possible. They're trying to force them out. There is nothing surgical about this. And even if it was, this is a full-blown occupation, and it is an illegal occupation. Hamas has every right to exist. Any resistance group has any right to exist. Illegal occupation. This is under the UN's own law. What they're trying to do here is bend laws, is take advantage of the fact that they are politically and militarily backed by the United States and commit a massacre of untold proportions. We have never seen anything like this in history, where such a sophisticated military has backed all these people into a specific corner, has deprived them of food and medicine, has broken them psychologically, has broken them physically, and now wants to finish them off. They're asking the world for permission to commit a massacre that will surely finish off the population of Gaza, and they want the world's approval to do it, but they have become so illegitimized, they have become a pariah state, and they're going to be unable to do this. And now they're trying to make a gamble at it and say that they're going to go in, and it's just not going to work out for them. This objective that they have of destroying Hamas is not going to work. And they don't even consider that every time that they kill a Palestinian, who else is going to rise up to the task of joining the resistance and fight back?
Right.
This is something that they are not considering whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, in terms of the truce talks, now Qatar is saying that the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution has not had any immediate effect on the talks, for now, at least. The Israeli media said the talks had fallen through. They blame Hamas's response to a U.S. proposal for a prisoner swap. Now, Hamas is saying that Israel is entirely responsible for the failure of the negotiation efforts. So do you see a ceasefire deal around the corner?
I do hope so, but I can imagine, I mean, you know, going on a high-level negotiation meetings of this sort, it's a very tense atmosphere. I mean, as a commercial lawyer, I have attended these negotiation sessions. It's a very, very tense atmosphere. And you need to have parity between the negotiating parties, if you know what I mean. In the sense of like they need to be of equal strength. But here we've got two parties of totally unequal strength. One party, which is supremacist in its ideology, in its position, in its assumption, it thinks it is superior to all other humans. And of course, in relation to Hamas, it sees itself as even more superior, and it sees Hamas as a mere hodgepodge of terror militia, which is not true, and they know it. But and so having negotiations in a room like that, it is filled with contempt by one side to the other side, and another side trying to uphold its rights with all it can, despite all the obstacles that it has in front of it. So it's a very difficult scenario, and I can imagine, I commend all those mediators who are in there, who are maintaining the peace in there. And so I hope there will be. I hope somebody will tell Israel, for God's sake, listen, the whole world now is aware of your heinous crimes. The whole world sees you as a proper psychopath. This is what you need to tell your client when you are negotiating like that, and you know your client is unreasonable.
Okay.
You have to bear upon them and tell them, listen, you are going to have to come enter into a deal here, and if you don't, then it's going to backfire on you very, very badly.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this episode of the Spotlight. I apologize for that. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, joined me from London. Shabir Rezvi, political commentator from Chicago. Appreciate it.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah desires ease for us in the holy month of Ramadan and our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here. Dear friends, we are talking about how Allah the Almighty desires ease for us in the holy month of Ramadan and in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, these kind of pointers are really important because if we don't have the right perception, if we don't have the right view, if we don't have the right understanding of the holy month of Ramadan, then what happens is that we're not able to benefit from the holy month of Ramadan because, you know, we're kind of turned off and we don't really understand the benefits, let alone try to acquire the benefits. So one of the most fundamental things, you know, that an individual needs to do is to understand the essence of the holy month of Ramadan. And, you know, of course, we can never fully understand the, you know, complete universal and cosmic depths of the holy month of Ramadan because it is so vast. But at least on a superficial level, there are very profound things about the holy month of Ramadan, you know, that we can try to understand. For example, the fact that it is a month in which we are easily able to connect with our Creator, the Almighty Allah. That in itself is such a huge thing if you start to think about it, you know. And a lot of times, the lifestyle that we live and this Western-oriented lifestyle that's been kind of forced down the throats of the people of the world is a lifestyle which prevents you from thinking. It doesn't allow you to think or contemplate. It doesn't allow you to reflect upon your life, upon your, you know, goal in living. It doesn't let you think about your future or your past or, you know, your deeds or your relationship with God. You know, it is a culture that it primarily just keeps you busy so that you're constantly in this rat race making money for somebody else.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how Allah desires ease for us in this holy month of Ramadan. You know, we had talked about in the previous segment how if we don't have the correct perception or the correct understanding of the holy month of Ramadan, then it's going to make it difficult for us to really take advantage of this holy month. And, you know, we said that thinking is something that is good. Contemplating, reflecting is something that is good and something that is highly encouraged in Islam, and it is highly discouraged in the Western culture and in Western discourse. So in the Holy Quran, Allah himself says in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 185 of chapter number 2. He says that Allah desires ease for you and He does not desire for you difficulty. And this is in respects to the holy month of Ramadan. So Allah wants ease for us. You know, if you're sick, for example, if you're traveling, if you are expecting a baby, even if you're suckling an infant, these are all situations in which an individual does not need to fast, right? So people that are not in this category, or for example, if, you know, small children as well, they kind of fall under those who are sick, or they fall under the category of those who are just not able to fast. They don't have the strength to do so, right? So when you take everybody else in, they're all strong, healthy, sane people. And so it is relatively easy for these people to fast. And you know, we've run out of time, but if we keep this in mind that Allah wants ease for us, He does not want difficulty, does not want to put us in a difficult position. If He puts us in a test or a trial, it's because Allah knows that we have the potential to be able to succeed. When we start to think like this, then it really impacts our holy month of Ramadan, and of course it impacts and has an effect on our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/EN. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa-Fulud battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemies' crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies. Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shah al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witnessed a cause by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide-and-rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism, amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Nowruz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowruz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowruz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowruz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowruz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods, and you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowruz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowruz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowruz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Nowruz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal. I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The Holy Month of Mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time. More specifically, volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So Saad Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken. And now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're going to put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country. United against all the odds, they strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital Beirut and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war."
If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon.
Experts tell Press TV that certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people. And especially that it is, and we have informations, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorshi Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though it is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its support of military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Thank you.
alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the 8th day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. As we had promised you, today we will go to Shiraz to make you familiar with the customs of Nowruz of the people in this beautiful and globally famous city. Stay with us, please. Shiraz is one of the most beautiful cities in Iran. This city is the destination of trip for many travelers in Nowruz, as the weather is good and everywhere one can feel the arrival of a spring. Shiraz is home to a variety of ethnicities, mainly Fars, Azeri, Lor, and Arab. Each of these ethnicities have certain customs and culture contributing to prosperity of the culture of Shiraz as a whole. Natives of Shiraz speak Farsi with a Shirazi dialect. Most of the people in the city are Shia Muslims, while small minorities of Jews and Christians have also lived there since old times. Shiraz is renowned all over the world as the land of poem, culture, garden, flower, and nightingale. Sa'di and Hafez are the two poets of Shiraz who have gained international fame for decades. They are the honor of Shiraz and Iran, and their poems have been translated to scores of languages. Traveling to Shiraz in spring is accompanied with the fragrance of bitter orange, that is citrus aurantium blossoms. The people of Fars province, especially the provincial capital of Shiraz, welcome the arrival of spring a few weeks before. They clean their houses, buy new clothes or fabric to sew new clothes. People of Shiraz usually pay a visit to the shrine of Shah Cheragh, a descendant of the Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him. They have other customs like preparing ash, a special kind of broth, and Fale Hafez, which means fortune-telling with the Divan of Hafez. In other words, they open a page of Hafez Book of Poetry randomly and read the poem. They believe that the implication of that poem will be the fate of the person in the coming year. Going to fish pond is another custom which used to be held in three cities of Shiraz, Fasa, and Zargan, but as the pond in Fasa has dried up, there are only two ponds for the custom. 10 meters below the tomb of Sa'di, there is a qanat, with compounds of phosphorus and quicksilver. Qanat or qanat is an underground aqueduct which transfers water to the surface. It flows into a pond called Hoze Mahi, fish pond, underground. The pond is on the left of the tomb. The interior is octagonal and reaches the yard of the tomb with 28 steps. Before the time of Sa'di and even in ancient Iran, there was water here and the water was sanctified.
According to the 14th century Muslim traveler Ibn Battuta, the pond was constructed by Sa'di. Today, people of Shiraz go to the pond, which is full of red fish, and cast coins in it with the hope of achieving their aspirations. But the people of Zargan gather around the pond and put a big pot on fire to make ash.